Sanka Coffee presents We the People.
Good evening, everyone. This is Gabriel Hito welcoming you to We the People for Sanka Coffee. Tonight you'll meet the daughter of Lillian Russell, the queen of the gay 90s, and a man who heard John Brown plan the attack on Harper's Ferry, the spark that started the Civil War. You'll meet a prize fighter who became a Metropolitan Opera star, and the world-famous scientist, Dunninger, who comes to tell one of the strangest ghost stories you've ever heard. And here, too, just arrived in America, is the European manager of the March of Time, come to give you an eyewitness account of the Maginot Line. These and many more, real people, come to tell experiences you hear only when we the people speak. One night last December, a tall, powerfully built young American singer made his debut at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York. Next morning, newspapers hailed him as one of the greatest American tenors of recent years. And tonight, that young opera star comes to this We the People microphone. Sanka Coffee is proud to present Mr. Avan LaHome.
As a kid out in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I had dreamed of being a singer. But voice lessons cost money and my folks were poor. By the time I was 16, I was alone in the world. One day I hopped a freight and headed west. I herded cattle, washed dishes and counter joints, and I guess I've swung a pick in every silver mine in Nevada and California. I used to dream about being a singer, but I couldn't do anything about it. So then I spent 3 years in Uncle Sam's Navy scrubbing decks. I was always handy with my fists, and when I was discharged, I was champ of my division. Then I thought maybe I could make enough money fighting to pay for the singing lessons I always wanted. Pretty soon I was boxing in big-time prelims. Then one night I had a real tough fight. I got knocked all over the ring. I knew if that fellow ever hit me in the throat, it might ruin my chances of ever being a singer. After that fight, I made up my mind to find out once and for all if I really had a voice. So I went to New York to see the famous vocal teacher, William S. Brady. After I sang for him, Mr. Brady said with training he believed I could go places. I got a job in a lunch wagon and started to take voice lessons. I kept that up for 5 years, scraping and saving all the money I could get my hands on. Then I went to Germany to continue my studies. Finally, I sang a minor role with the Berlin Opera Company. In the next few years, I sang in opera houses all over Europe. Then last December, I got the chance every singer dreams of. I opened at the world-famous Metropolitan Opera House in New York, singing a featured role in the opera Walküre. And at last, the dreams I've had all these years had come true. Now I'd like to sing one of my favorite songs, Franz Lehár's Yours Is My Heart Alone.
Dein ist meine ganze Welt, wo du nicht bist, kann ich nicht sein. So wie die Blume welt, wenn sie nicht kriecht, der Sonnenschein. Allein ist mein falsches Lied, weil sie allein aus der Liebe erblüht. Oh, sag noch einmal, oh, sag noch einmal, ja, ich hab dich lieb. Hör dich dein Stimmklang, ist es so wie Musik. Dein ist mein ganzes Herz, wo du nicht bist, kann ich nicht sein. So, sag noch einmal, oh, sag noch einmal, ja, ich kann.
You believe in ghosts? Well, probably you don't, and neither do I. But neither did Tom Carpenter and his wife, Eleanor, until one stormy night in May 1938, when they came to spend a summer in the old Carpenter homestead, the Adirondack Mountains near Keysville, New York, a house which had been empty since the death of Tom Carpenter's father 10 years before. And as the rain came pelting down upon them, Tom forced open the weather-beaten old door leading into a deserted living room.
All right, Eleanor, in we go.
Tom, I'm nervous. This house is so dark and strange looking.
Now, dear, we'll have the place cleaned and aired out thoroughly. Inside of a week, it'll be as cozy a place as we could want. Now, come on, dear, let's go inside. Here, I'll light this candle so we can take a look around.
Oh, Tom, look. See those horrid spider webs on the fireplace. Oh, and it's so musty in here. It's like a tomb.
Look, dear, there on the mantle. His father's old guitar, hanging there just as he left it 10 years ago. You know, I remember how Dad used to love to strum that guitar in the evenings with all us kids gathered around the fireplace.
Tom, I have a strange feeling about this house. It's almost as though your father were right here watching us. Look, Tom, I don't want to stay here. Please, I'm really frightened.
Now, dear, we'll be all right. Come on, let's go upstairs. In the morning, you'll be perfect.
Tom, wake up.
Ella, what's the matter?
Listen, the guitar. Can't you hear it?
Why?
I tell you, there's someone downstairs, Tom. I can hear music.
It does sound like that guitar. I'm going down and see.
Wait a minute, I'm coming with you. Loud it is.
Hello. Hello in there. Hello, who's there? Wait till I get some light. Why, there's no one here. There's not a sound, and see, the guitar is still hanging right over the fireplace.
But, Tom, I know I heard someone playing that guitar. Tom, what does it mean? Who's been here?
I don't know. I'm beginning to think maybe what folks are saying is right. Maybe this house is haunted.
Look, the guitar. There's something white coming out of it. Oh, Tom, I can feel it. It's touching my face.
For one awful week, the young couple were awakened each night by the weird sound of guitar playing ringing through the ruined farmhouse. And finally, in desperation, Tom Carpenter called upon the noted mentalist and America's foremost psychic investigator, known to thousands in scientific circles as Dunninger. Dunninger is here at this We the People microphone tonight. And he comes to tell us what he found in that ghostly farmhouse in the Adirondacks. All right, sir.
When I arrived at the Carpenter place, I found Mr. Carpenter terribly excited and his wife on the verge of collapse. That night, I sent them upstairs to try and get some rest. Then I turned out all the lights, sat down by the fireplace in the living room. I guess it was along about 3 a.m. when I heard music. I jumped up, directed my flashlight upon the guitar hanging on its rack over the fireplace. Then something white struck me full in the face. I clutched at my cheek and saw in my hand the crumbled form of a giant moth. Then I knew I had solved one more mystery. A family of giant moths had rested inside the sound box of the guitar. And at night, when the house was still and the moths would flutter about, striking the steel strings of the guitar, would naturally cause this weird, odd, curious sound. I've investigated hundreds of haunted houses and all sorts of ghostly apparitions. I've never found one yet that didn't have a simple, natural explanation. Before the famous magician Harry Houdini died, he left me a message of 10 words that he said he would try to commune to me after death, if spirit communication was possible. Thousands of people have brought me messages supposed to be from the late Houdini. But they never brought the one message Houdini said he would try to send, if possible. I also have codes agreed upon with Thomas Edison and the magician Howard Thurston. Neither of them ever got a message through, naturally after passing. Tonight, as chairman of the Universal Council for Psychic Research, I want to repeat the challenge that's gone unanswered for 12 years. If anyone listening can show me a so-called genuine, spiritualistic, physical phenomenon that I cannot explain or duplicate by natural or scientific means, my society will pay them $10,000 in cash.
Brain is on fire, the bedclothes conspire of usual slumber to plunder you. First your counterpane goes and uncovers your toes, and your sheet slips demurely from under you. Then the blanketing tickles, you feel like mixed pickles, so terribly sharp is the pricking. And you're hot and you're cross and you tumble and toss till there's nothing but you and the ticking. Then the bedclothes all creep to the ground in a heap, and you pick them all up in a tangle. Next your pillow resigns and politely declines to remain at its usual angle. Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, is a little something that Gilbert and Sullivan dreamed up many, many years ago. The Chancellor's Nightmare. But it's so true a picture of the way some of you spend your nights that it might easily have been written watching you. Especially if you're the sort of person who drinks ordinary coffee when you shouldn't. Because ordinary coffee contains caffeine. And caffeine does keep many people turning and tossing till daybreak. Now, Sanka coffee gives you the refreshment of coffee without the disturbing after effects. Sanka is rich and fragrant, really wonderfully delicious. And it will never rob anybody of a single moment's sleep, because 97% of the caffeine has been removed. So if you like fine coffee and you like your sleep, too, be sure to get the delicious coffee that never interferes with sleep. Sanka coffee.
The gay 90s, the days of the tandem bike, the bustle, and the handlebar mustache, the days of fabulous Diamond Jim Brady, and the toast of New York, the glamorous singing star Lillian Russell. But tonight at this We the People microphone is a woman who knew Lillian Russell better than any other living person, for Lillian Russell was her mother. Sanka Coffee presents Miss Dorothy Russell of New York City.
I'll always remember my mother, Lillian Russell, as the most beautiful woman I ever saw. When I was a little girl, she always used to take me to the theater where she was playing, and she used to put me to bed in a trunk in her dressing room. One night I woke up and ran downstairs looking for Mother. She was out on the stage singing. I walked right out beside her and started to sing with her. But when I saw all the people, I got so scared that I stopped singing and clung to Mother's skirts. One day, Mother introduced me to a heavy-set, red-faced man with diamonds gleaming in his shirt front. It was Diamond Jim Brady. One night, Diamond Jim called at our hotel carrying a heavy Gladstone bag. I opened the door, and he came in and said to Mother, "Miss Russell, please don't be insulted. I want to ask your hand in marriage and his a little engagement gift." Then he opened the Gladstone bag. I saw stacks of greenbacks. Altogether, there was $1,000,000 in that bag. I saw Mother smile, and she said, "Jim, I can't take your money. I think you're a dear, and I always will, but I'm sorry. Let's just always be friends." And they always were. I'll never forget the clothes that Mother wore. She spent more than $100,000 a year on them. She wore gorgeous big hats decorated with ostrich plumes and paradise costing $1,000 each. And one time I remember going to a store with her. She tried on a dozen dresses and finally picked one decorated with pearls. It cost $4,000. But Mother never forgot that there were few as fortunate as she was, and she was always helping somebody else. That's why I know I speak for others when I say the name of my mother, Lillian Russell, will never be forgotten.
It never will be, I'm sure.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown, a name that in the bitter yesterdays of the Civil War had become a deadly symbol of brother against brother. A name to sing into battle and a name to hate. John Brown was an abolitionist. His plans to free the slaves were those of a wild-eyed dreamer. Even so, he had his followers. Followers who gathered around this great hulk of a man late one night in a lantern-lit barn a few miles from Harper's Ferry in Virginia.
In the grave, John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave.
I will never get inside that arsenal, John.
But there's 10 soldiers standing guard.
Quiet. I tell you we can do it. We've got 20 men. And once we arm the Negroes, we'll have an army.
Well, it's a long chance.
There's a gun for each of them in the arsenal.
All right. We're with you.
Then it's agreed. Remember, tomorrow night, 9 o'clock, we'll meet by the clump of sycamores down back of the arsenal.
Body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering.
It's 9:30. That's when the guards change.
And that's when we move. Remember, I'll fire 2 shots. That's the signal for the others. Quiet. Now, come on! Head for the gates!
Clear the gates!
Come on in! This way! Follow me! Follow me!
John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, and the end of John Brown's plot to arm and free the slaves. John Brown survived that bloody battle, only to march to the gallows. But to the man here at our We the People microphone now, John Brown is still a living, vivid memory. For he was in that dimly lit barn with his father the night John Brown laid his plans. Sanka Coffee presents Thomas Peacock of Saranac Lake, New York. He's 90 years old. All right, sir.
I was only a little boy then, but I can still see that barn. When John Brown walked back and forth, his big white beard made him look mighty fierce, and there was a wild look in his eye. I was awful scared. John Brown kept away, saying, "We got to stick together," but my father wouldn't join up. He told me not to tell anyone that I had seen and heard whether John Brown was right or wrong ain't for me to say, but I am mighty glad I lived long enough to see our country united forever.
Mark Warner and his orchestra. There's magic in that name, ladies and gentlemen, and magic in their music. For years, the music of Mark Warner has thrilled listeners from coast to coast. And for 3 seasons, it's been a bright feature on our own program of We the People. For tonight, Mark's asked if he could lay down his baton and for the first time introduce one of our guests. Ladies and gentlemen, Sanka Coffee is happy to present its maestro, Mark Warner.
Thanks, Gabe. About 5 years ago, I was conducting a series of programs for the Columbia Broadcasting System that were devoted to the works of unknown composers. One night, my kid brother Harry came in and said, "Mark, I've been writing some music. How about looking at it?" I said, "Listen, kid, I've got enough to do besides worrying about your music. But if you insist, leave it in the desk and I'll get around to it later." That night, I went through a pile of manuscripts, and at midnight, I came on a song that really opened my eyes, and it was signed Harry Warner. But one thing worried me. If I played Harry's music, people would think I did so just because he was my kid brother. so I told him he'd have to use another name. We took a telephone book, tore it in half, and we began to look for another name for Harry Warnow. We must have tried 1,000, and finally, after 5 years, we found one we both liked. He's done wonderfully well with that new name of his. In fact, he's done so well with his new name, I've been thinking maybe I ought to change mine. Because since then, he has written such hits as Twilight and Turkey, Toy Trumpet, and In an 18th Century Drawing Room. And now I'd like you to hear from my kid brother himself under the name we picked out from the telephone book, Raymond Scott.
Well, Mark put me to work playing piano in his band, and a week didn't go by that one of the boys wouldn't come over to tell me a really big secret, that he had discovered who Raymond Scott really was. One fellow said he was a colored hot trumpet player in Harlem. Another fellow said he was a famous English classical composer who sold his crazy stuff under the name of Raymond Scott. For 2 years, Mark and I kept our secret. Finally, after one rehearsal, Mark said, "Boys, would you like to meet Raymond Scott?" Everybody got excited and said, "Sure." He pointed his baton at me and said, "Harry, I want you to take a bow."
Well, Harry, or rather Ray, you know, Mark's saying 5 years instead of 5 hours. He's got us all twisted up here. You know, your pieces have the queerest names I ever heard of. Dinner music for a pack of hungry cannibals. Square dance for 8 Egyptian mummies. Say, tell me, how do you go about naming your song?
There's a story that I rarely tell on the radio. It goes like this, that some of my titles are based on legends. Take, for example, War Dance for Wooden Indians. It seems that in a small deserted town in Oklahoma, there's an old abandoned warehouse full of many thousands of cigar store wooden Indians. And many natives there have sworn that twice a year at midnight, these wooden Indians come to life and go into a frenzied ceremonial war dance. And it is this fantastic legend on which I based my composition, War Dance for Wooden Indians.
Say, that's a wonderful legend, Ray. Where'd you hear it?
I made it up myself.
You know, Gabe, that's what he always does. He makes up the legends to fit his titles.
Well, Mark, I've got Ray's new record of The Businessman's Bounce and The Huckleberry Duck. But I know there's one favorite we'd all like to hear. In an 18th century drawing room. How about playing it?
Well, sure, Gabe. But we'll have to try something new. We're going to conduct it together. I'm going to conduct the brass section. And you, Raymond, you'll conduct the saxes, won't you?
Mark, I'll be happy to do that, but only on one condition.
What's that one condition?
That if you come to my broadcast, which goes on after We the People on most of these same stations, and conduct half of my band with me.
It's a deal. And, kid, you got a swell plug-in, too. All right, everybody, in an 18th century drawing room.
Mr. Webster wants to find the word comfort as freedom from annoyance, ease, contentment. Well, Harry Von Zell has still another definition, namely,
good coffee, ladies and gentlemen, because to many people, good coffee is comfort. Its cheering warmth and refreshment, its delicious depth of flavor, contribute a rich and heartwarming satisfaction that almost nothing else can quite equal. And every one of you can enjoy this satisfaction in double measure if the coffee you choose is Sanka coffee. Because Sanka is not only coffee at its finest, mellow, full-bodied, delicious from first sip to last, but it's coffee that will never cost you a moment's regret afterwards, never rob you of a single wink of sleep. And the explanation is simply this. Coffee in itself never disturbs anybody's sleep. It's the caffeine in ordinary coffees that does the damage. and Sanka coffee has had 97% of the caffeine removed. So if you're a person affected by the caffeine in ordinary coffees, be sure to try Sanka coffee. Your grocer has it now not only in the regular grind, but in the popular new drip grind as well. Both at the lowest price in history. And no matter how late you drink it, no matter how often you drink it, you can always drink Sanka coffee and sleep. Sleep like a baby. Sleep.
The Maginot Line. Everyday headlines bring news from that famous fortress on the Western Front. What's it like to face enemy guns from the grim caverns of the Maginot Line? Sanka Coffee's next guest knows. He's just come from there. We the People presents Mr. Richard de Rochemont, European manager for the March of Time and an associate editor of Life magazine. All right, sir.
Just a short time ago, I drove along a frozen road somewhere in France in a French army car bound for the Maginot Line. In the distance, I heard the boom of artillery fire, and a squadron of French planes droned overhead. At the underground entrance to the French fortifications in the Maginot Line, I showed my credentials, walked inside, and the heavy steel door clanged shut behind me. The interior of a fort of the Maginot Line is like a huge battleship, sunk below the surface of the earth. The air is musty, dank, alternately cold as a tomb or warm in the heated living quarters. One day I went with a medical party, going forward to take care of any wounded soldiers brought in from the patrols operating in no man's land. As we made our way quietly through the forest, here and there I saw craters that had been dug into the earth by shell fire. And we passed French batteries, hidden by a camouflage of brush and debris, firing toward the Siegfried Line. Finally, we came to a barbed wire barrier. The officer with me whispered, "This is our last outpost. We'll wait here for the stretcher bearers to return from the raid." After meeting the returning patrol party, we made our way back to the Maginot Line. This time we traveled through a deserted village that had been captured from the Germans. One of the soldiers pointed to a tin can lying by the side of the road. He said, "Don't pick up any junk for souvenirs. Many of our men who picked up objects like that have had their legs blown off by a hidden hand grenade or a landmine." From what I saw and heard, I can say that these hundreds of thousands of men who guard the French frontier are prepared to hang on as long as they are needed. Lots of them told me so, just as they also told me that they have no love for the dreary business of war. No soldier has. But, like all soldiers, they said they must face the fact that only by their personal sacrifice can they obtain permanent security for the land they love.
We the People speak. Next week, at the same time, you'll meet more famous personalities, people from all walks of life, telling experiences which reveal drama, laughter, and thrills, just as they've done tonight. Wouldn't you like to appear on this program of We the People? Well, think back about your own life. Perhaps you've had an experience that you feel will interest other people. If you have, send it to the Listener's Radio Committee. You may win a free trip to New York with all expenses paid by Sanka Coffee. Tell your story when we the people speak.
Ladies and gentlemen, we regret that last-minute commitments in connection with Mr. Hoover's work with the Finnish Relief Fund made it impossible for him to be with us tonight. And now Sanka Coffee bids you good night. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.